Today's episode is brought to you by Empower. It doesn't matter how much money you have, we all have money questions. Empower is here to answer those questions so you don't have to worry. Take control of your financial future with a real-time dashboard and real live conversations to empower what's next. Start today at empower.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
I think it's pretty fair to say that not many of us had heard much about Antifa before the protests in Charlottesville, or it certainly wasn't a household name by any stretch. Antifa, which derives from anti-fascist, is a small faction of leftists who are willing to use violence when necessary to confront their opponents. They're the people that Trump was talking about when he referred to violence on many sides. Although at Charlottesville, only one side rammed a car into a crowd and killed someone. Still, the notion that violence can be legitimate, even for a good cause, has a lot of people on the left and on the right very upset. And Antifa has been accused of inciting violence in Berkeley and elsewhere. One of the best ways to get a handle on what the movement means is a new book by Mark Bray called Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. I spoke with Mark Bray last week. One point you make is that the vast majority of Antifa tactics are nonviolent. Can you explain what some of those tactics are?
Certainly.
Because we don't see them much.
Right. Well, that's part of the issue, right, is you literally don't see them because a lot of these groups are very secretive about what they do. So certainly a lot of it is essentially thankless drudgery of monitoring white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups on multiple media platforms, trying to figure out who their members are, where they're meeting, who they're working with, where they're trying to hold events, and in many cases, making phone calls or organizing boycotts against venues to try and stop them from hosting these people, trying to contact employers to let them know that their employees are arguing on the internet that Hitler was right, alerting communities that may be under attack. So there is a variety that's done, and quite often there are events that are stopped or shut down before anyone even hears about it. And then you can see that the sort of the level of confrontation is to some extent a last resort when stopping these kinds of events hasn't succeeded. And so that's what sort of needs to be taken into account when we think about what anti-fascism looks like as a whole.
So my understanding is that while there are many liberal groups and many liberal institutions in this country that have been anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-white supremacist. We're not talking about liberalism here. We're talking about an amalgam
right.
of groups that are something else. What are they?
Right. So what you point to is very important. The term anti-fascist, of course, was used for essentially anyone who opposed fascism during World War II. What we're talking about here is a specific pan-radical left politics that is not only about combating fascism, but also has an essentially socialist message. And it has both a revolutionary analysis and a historical analysis, which thinks that some of these mechanisms, whether it be debate, the police, the state, failed in the interwar period to consistently stop the fascist advance, at times even aided the fascist advance, and that's why they argue that direct action is the best method to counteract it.
Well, there's direct action and there's direct action, right? There's civil protests of a kind that we saw in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war
right.
movement. And then there are violent protests and a lack of order that we've seen at other times. And research shows us that violent protests, violent riots and uprisings often flip people to the other side. So that in 1968, when you had a lot of violence in the street, you saw Richard Nixon win, not his Democratic opponent. Now, radicals may think that there's really no difference between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, but the world may think otherwise. What's your view on that?
Sure. So you're referring to the sort of research around strategic nonviolence, and a number of scholars have debated the evidence to show whether nonviolence and violence works. I think that the first thing to say is that it's often hard to isolate the effectiveness of either strategy because in just about every historical circumstance, you have some manifestation of both tendencies going on at the same time. So, you know, in terms of the 60s, obviously nonviolence was very powerful and very successful, but you also have the looming threat of what happens if these nonviolent protests are not listened to and the methods and the solutions to injustice that they propose are not put into effect. So the threat of a looming race war made certain nonviolent proposals seem more legitimate than they might have seemed otherwise. I'm not sure in the case of fascism, when it comes to power, when it really doesn't respond to public opinion, when it clamps down upon it, if you can always count on purely nonviolent means to leverage that kind of public opinion.
Are you saying that the Nazis came to power because of a lack of will to crack heads in the streets?
No, that's an oversimplification. What I'm saying is that had the Communist Party of Germany, had the Socialist Party of Germany considered Nazism to be a grave threat several years before it came to power, which it really did not consider it to be a grave threat until several, maybe a year or two in, because the slogan of the Communist Party when Hitler took power was first Hitler, then us. So they believed that when Hitler got into power, he would be a fad, he would do such a poor job in government that he would be a one-trick pony and he'd be done quickly.
But hang on, Mark. So let's bring it to the present tense. In your view, what is the nature of the Trump presidency? Is this a fascist presidency in your view?
No, not at all. But I would say that Trump has fascistic qualities. His cult of personality, his glorification of violence, his sort of protectionist opposition to an absolutely free market grounded in sort of an economic and really a subtly racialized nationalism, his xenophobia and so forth, right? And so certainly his connection to the alt-right, the way that he's pandered to a certain kind of white nationalist sentiment, those are causes for concern.
Now, I realize the Antifa movement has other tactics besides anything violent. But the fact is that we have seen things go to violence in various places, including Berkeley. If you have an arsonist in the White House, why hand them the matches? Why hand them the PR victory?
Good question. Well, part of it is to understand that most anti-fascists are revolutionaries and are not specifically concerned about who's in the White House and are as a whole, not necessarily super concerned with what you think about them. But I can tell you why I agree with much of what they say. And you and your listeners can take it for what it is. Certainly, I think most people would agree that there came a point, we can debate when that point was, but there came a point at which self-defense against neo-Nazis and fascists was legitimate historically. And we can see today in Europe and parts of the United States that there are populations who are regularly threatened and attacked by white supremacists, by police who are sympathetic to them. And the legitimacy of self-defense, even in many cases, very illegal self-defense, to me seems like an ethical response to that. And we can see that the way that fascists grow historically can be short-circuited by concerted organizing, and why not do it? So if you look, for example, to the Battle of Cable Street in London in 1936, there was a fascist march planned through the East End of London, which was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. A lot of the Jewish population there participated with leftists to block the path of this fascist march. Certainly the majority of British society, which was, of course, predominantly non-Jewish, thought that blocking this march was a disgrace and completely criticized this action in the media. So in the context of the 1930s, if the Jewish population of London wanted to sort of cater to the popular opinion, they probably would have just let the march pass through. But that we can see in the case of Nazi Germany that you can't always rely on the majority population to defend your interests if you're a minority.
In Skokie, Illinois, some decades back, mm-hmm. Nazis marched through the streets of a largely Jewish town.
Yes.
And this was painful to so many people, myself included, and countless other people, mm-hmm. but there is a freedom of assembly. There's freedom of speech. Isn't that the higher value? It's certainly the higher liberal value.
Certainly the higher liberal value, but the question is, when a certain population is facing a sort of lived illiberalism in the degree to which certain attacks upon them are eroding their actual lived experience of, you know, enjoying rights, when those kinds of values fall apart and you get a white supremacist movement that's targeting people and the majority population doesn't necessarily really care, What do you do about it? You know, so that's, it's sort of a variation. You can look at black nationalism as another example of certain kinds of political formations not trying to cater their politics to what the majority of white people are thinking because they don't necessarily share the same interests.
Do you consider him naive in this sense?
No, not at all. I just think he has a different perspective. I mean, I'm not trying to convince everyone to agree with me. I'm just trying to articulate why this perspective is intelligible.
You know, to my mind, maybe the most dramatic anti-white supremacist moment in American history, and there are many of them, occurred in Selma in 1965, led by John Lewis and others. And people met the dogs and electric cattle prods and violence of white supremacists and the police, it should be pointed out, by peaceful means, by civil disobedience. And there was a lot of blood, and there was a lot of pain, and they won. And they won.
Correct.
Do you think these tactics bring victory, or does it bring more civil strife?
I'm not trying to argue that any tactic is always the best tactic. I'm trying to argue that there are times when different tactics are better than others. And I'm not trying to tell anyone not to do it. I'm just saying that sometimes when you get attacked by armed neo-Nazis, it's legitimate to defend yourself.
Let me ask you this, and I realize you're a scholar of this as well as, but somebody with some sympathies with this. As a citizen not only of the United States, but of Dartmouth, if Dartmouth invited Steve Bannon to speak or Ann Coulter, what would you do about it or not?
Personally, I might write an op-ed criticizing it. I would protest it, but personally, that's probably all I would do, if you're curious.
And for those who would do a lot more and try to do everything they could to prevent their speaking, how do you feel about them?
I think it's contextual. It depends on what is done. I mean, certainly, you know, all politics depends on what's done when by whom. But I think the notion of using civil disobedience methods to stop a speech by Steve Bannon is a legitimate response to that. Sure.
Mark Bray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Bray is a historian and visiting scholar at Dartmouth College. His book is called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.